We got another edition of the Ambassadors Insiders podcast. On this month's episode, we're going to discuss a couple of really key developments here in Washington as they relate to tax reform and some of the broader political dynamics at play. My name is Josh Caron. I'm joined by a couple of regular fixtures here on the pod. We got Armstrong Robinson, Vice President of Legislative Affairs, and David Hollingsworth, Senior Director of Policy and Content Development, being here as well. So thank you guys. Appreciate you taking the time to join us. We've got a ton to talk about on the tax front, so I want to get there as quickly as possible. But really quick, first, let's talk about a couple of political developments that we've seen here over the last month. First, let's start with healthcare, because, of course, we have to start with healthcare. After the Trump administration's surprise deal with, and I put in air quotes here, Chuck and Nancy last month, they kicked the can down the road a little bit until December on funding the government and raising the debt ceiling. So Senate Republicans try to take advantage of that opening to breathe some new life into repealing Obamacare. Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy, they crafted legislation that would have kept some of the Obamacare taxes, but instead of would have rolled that money and any money that was earmarked for Medicaid expansion into block grants for states, and they could then decide how to implement their own healthcare systems. Graham Cassidy did pick up a lot of steam in the Senate, but his previous versions of repeal did fell just a couple short shy of actually passing. So unfortunately, with the fiscal year budget ending on September 30th and with the opportunity to pass it through reconciliation go along with that, in the immediate term, this likely put healthcare reform on ice, although it will remain a political issue moving forward here. In addition, we had some interesting developments on the Republican side in the Senate. First, Bob Corker, a widely respected senator from Tennessee, has decided he won't run for re-election in 2018. Senator Corker is the chairman of the important Senate Foreign Relations Committee and is a close confidant of Leader McConnell, who is really well known for his policy chops and his willingness to work across the aisle. Second major development is a special election down in Alabama. After the first primary vote failed to produce a winner, the race entered a runoff between sitting Senator Luther Strange and Judge Roy Moore. For all you folks who don't know, Strange was appointed by the governor of Alabama, to replace now Attorney General Jeff Sessions. In the race, President Trump and Leader McConnell endorsed Senator Strange and spent considerable resources supporting him, with the president going down to Alabama a few days before the election to campaign on his behalf. And then Steve Bannon actually supported Firebrand Moore, who had been twice removed from the Alabama Supreme Court. In the end, Moore ended up with a 9-point win and will now face off against a Democratic challenger in December. It's likely that Moore will win that contest in the deep red state of Alabama, and thereby replacing a reliable McConnell ally with a man who ran heavily against McConnell and establishment Republicans here in Washington. What effect that might have on getting legislation passed in the Senate remains to be seen, though. So we'll just keep our eye on that. With that, guys, let's go ahead and pivot to taxes. We've seen a couple of major developments on two fronts here. One, the budget, and two, the tax framework that was recently released by the administration. So let's start with the budget, because that's oftentimes, or in this case, is the starting point for all this. So, Army, walk us through some of the recent developments on that side.
Sure. Thanks, Josh. Good to be with you all today. As regular listeners of the pod will remember, the budget process is critical, most simply because it provides a filibuster protection for a potential tax reform vehicle. Normally, this process, the budget would be resolved by April 15th of any given calendar year for the ensuing fiscal year. That obviously is well delayed this year, but last week, Senators Corker, who Josh has already mentioned, and Toomey from Pennsylvania, both Republicans who sit on the Budget Committee, came to an agreement that has been well publicized, effectively setting a cap in the reconciliation process for tax reform that would allow it to lose $1.5 trillion over 10 years. So effectively, that allows on a static scoring basis for them to do a tax cut that cost that much over the year. So when they add that to the base broadeners and the other things they're going to do to offset their tax package, they have $1.5 trillion in extra score to allocate. The Senate Budget Committee will mark up their budget next week. The House budget, or the House will move forward their budget to the floor next week. And largely, it's going to take at least 3 weeks in October for them to get this process finalized. And just for those of you keeping up, the House and the Senate have to pass the identical documents in order to give the reconciliation instructions that give the filibuster protection for tax reform. And so you combine that, and I know we're going to turn to the tax framework in a minute, with the statements from Chairman Hatch and Brady that they won't release a tax bill, legislative text, until the budget is done. And you can reasonably be assured that at this point, we won't see actual tax legislation for another 3 or 4 weeks. But really, you know, this week was the starting gun. We are now off to the races. Tax reform is coming. That doesn't mean it's going to get all the way home. And I would refer you all to definitely take a look at the document David Hollingsworth produced this week on the tax framework. And we'll start going through some of that here in a minute.
Real quick, before we pivot to that, talk about a little bit about the dynamics of Corker and Toomey. There have been a little bit of, you know, a back and forth between those two about how much deficit spending or potentially they were willing to have in there. And then a little bit on the House with the Freedom Caucus guys, why they decided to jump on board after kind of being a little bit hesitant at first.
So there are various stripes and tribes to the modern American conservative movement in the Republican Party. On tax, the absolutist supply-siders believe that no matter how much you cut taxes, the resulting economic growth will more than pay for the revenue loss from the tax cut. There are an increasing or a balancing number of deficit hawks who believe that you get some growth effect in making up revenue, but it's not absolute and it's not it has some constraint around it. And so Mr. Toomey in this budget deal represented the supply siders, cut as much as we can, as deep as we can, and it all get made up on the growth side. And Mr. Corker represented the deficit hawks, who said, yeah, we're going to give you a certain amount of credit for that, but not an unending amount of credit. And that's their balance came to the $1.5 trillion. Switching to the House, the now infamous Freedom Caucus in the House, they, for the most part, fall into the supply side camp. And they had withheld their votes on the House budget until they had enough clarity about what the tax bill would be. They announced this week that they endorsed the framework and would release their votes for the budget. There's a ton of excessive attention around the Freedom Caucus in general in Washington and around the country. They are about 40 members of the House, and so they can deny passage on most anything if they act together. The two things that often are lost are, one, they don't act together all that often, and two, they aren't enough to pass anything on their own, which does provide some limits to their power. Also, there is a fairly sizable block of deficit hawks in the House who care about the fact that we just crossed $20 trillion in debt 2 weeks ago and believe that the federal budget ought to mean something about deficit reduction and ultimately debt pay downs. And so that's also a balance in, you know, the 3 week timeline on getting the budget done is if everything goes right. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who's been watching Washington this year, that hasn't happened yet. And so it could push longer.
Okay. So we'll keep an eye on that. So let's just assume though, for this point, that we've got a budget. That means, like Army said earlier, it's go time on taxes. So we've been expecting something to come from the administration and along the lines of a framework that maybe outlines some of the contours of what we could potentially expect in a tax reform bill. So, David, walk us through a little bit. You guys just put out that great piece on what was in this. So tell us a little bit on the corporate side. What do they have in that bill, or in the framework, excuse me?
Sure. Thanks, Josh. And so, yeah, the big six is, just to remind everybody, is House Speaker Paul Ryan and Ways and Means Chairman Kevin Brady, Also, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Finance Chairman Orrin Hatch, along with Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin and National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn. Those are the ones that have really been driving this over the last few months and trying to get a framework that they can all agree on, at least at the broad levels, before they fill in the details. So just first, in terms of impact on the life insurance industry, there were no CAMP provisions specifically listed. So this includes the subchapter L tax, company taxes, also the things of effects on COLI, as well as the virtual elimination of the non-qualified deferred comp market. So none of those are in there. On the other hand, the state tax or full state tax repeal was included, as well as full repeal of the GST tax. This was expected as an initial draft, as kind of a starting point, particularly as it's going to go through the House. And Army will get into a little more detail of that when we go into the individual side. Just one thing to note, there was a paragraph in the framework that dealt with special tax regimes and kind of left, they were going to do some changes there with nothing specified. We've had no indication that was specifically aimed at us or anything, and there's been some talk about extractive industries being the one of the targets there. But, of course, as always, particularly what happened in 2014, we're going to stay vigilant as that develops. So just real quick on some of the other key provisions. The corporate rate was at 20%. Trump had been talking about 15, but Ryan had always been with 20, and that's the rate they ended up with. 25% pass-through rate on that. Full immediate expensing for at least 5 years was included. In the blueprint, Chairman Brady had talked about full expensing, but it talked about being open to some types of phasing, so the five-year mark was in the framework. Also mentioned was the partial elimination of deduction for net interest for C-Corps. There was no specific figure or other details, so obviously partial, that's quite a big spread, so yet to see where they're going to go on that, as well as the elimination of the Section 199 domestic manufacturing credits. In terms of the territorial system, this is not going to be kind of the fundamental reform that was envisioned when border adjustability was originally part of the House framework, but there is going to be a one-time repatriation of foreign profits at a low rate, and they also are going to have, going forward, a 100% exemption for dividends of foreign subsidiaries. So I know when I first came to D.C. in 2005, there was talk about a one-time corporate tax, one of these repatriation holidays, and this would be the one time, and they never asked for it again. And then they come back. This is the Republican attempt to say, if we're going to do it, let's fix the issues of incentives for doing it in the first place and try to do more than just this one-time thing. So that was where they are on territorial. But that's really just the highlights on the details there, Josh.
Good. No. So, Army, David just kind of ran through the corporate side. So what was in there on the individual side here?
Yeah, before I get to the individual side, let me back up and give one piece of context. Everybody focused in April on the administration's one-pager. This framework, if you haven't read it, is 9 pages, and there have been any number of jokes for those of you with college and high school age children about the creative spacing and margins that we all used when we had to hit page limits for the professors. If you want the positive spin on it, they have left a lot of discretion to Congress and to the tax writers to determine the details of the ultimate tax reform bill. If you want the sort of less optimistic view of things, they couldn't really agree to that much more on the front side. The other description that I enjoy about the framework this week is that it was all candy, no spinach. There was lots of the goodies in here that some might describe as positives in tax reform writ large to the economy, but not a lot of the ways you were going to get there. One of the cardinal examples, and now I'll shift to Josh's question about individual. So one of the key points of the framework is collapsing the current 7 individual tax rates down to 3. And so the new rates will be, according to the framework, would be 12, 25, and 35. But there's this asterisk in the plan that says Congress may, if they want to, add a 4th high income bracket. And so we've heard some rumblings about a millionaire's tax on earned income and some other things like that.
And they also don't give you any indication of where those brackets start. So you don't know where it's going to actually, the dollar amount's going to begin or end.
That's correct. And of course, that bottom bracket went from 10 to 12, which, if you want to get into a long-winded explanation, because they've doubled the standard deduction, actually means that according to them, and with some credence, the bottom earners will end up better off or no worse off than they were. But effectively, by doing so, they're left to try to explain what Chuck, Josh's buddy in the Senate, has been using as a huge baseball bat to beat them for raising taxes on the poor. And, of course, it requires some understanding of tax policy and a fairly lengthy explanation to show how that's not, in fact, the case, because you've doubled the standard deduction. So the administration talks about the zero bracket, which, you know, is lost on most people.
And there's always the adage, if you're explaining, you're losing.
That's right. That's exactly right. But we have no clarity about where these breakpoints are in the rates. And so there's, you know, just a tremendous amount to still understand there. Both, I think David may have mentioned this, both the corporate and the individual AMTs are envisioned as repealed, as we expected, and so shouldn't be taken with too great an alarm. Estate tax repeal and GST repeal were in the plan. That's not inconsistent where we thought things would be, and so we're continuing to work our strategy around those delicate issues. As I mentioned, they effectively double the standard deduction. One of the big pay-fors and one of the big walls they've already begun to run into for this latest plan is eliminating the state and local tax deduction for individuals. That scores at roughly $1.3 trillion if they can do it. And interestingly enough, based on the political makeup, it's not a problem in the Senate, which is where most things die. But in the House, where there's roughly 45 to 52 Republican members from high tax jurisdictions who may join with their governors and say, no, we don't want this eliminated. David mentioned the catch-all around industries, which we're obviously very concerned about. There was this sort of, there's this vague paragraph about specialized treatment industries will also be critically looked at. You know, that always gets our hackles up. It's a flag, not a grenade, so we're continuing to watch it. The other piece that was very positive around that front that specifically does address our work is there was a definitive, so the two named protected, quote unquote, deductions were the mortgage interest and the charitable deduction, but then there was additional language there about protecting and enhancing retirement savings vehicles for Americans. So that was a positive from there.
I would say on that point, if you guys could expand a little bit, I don't know, David, Army, whoever wants to take this, but we'd heard a little bit about Rothification, and I would assume that would kind of be under the context it would fall in. So maybe explain what's kind of floating out there and how this, it doesn't seem like that's, you know, explicitly laid out in the framework anywhere, but if you guys have heard anything or kind of explain a little bit of what that is.
So Rothification has been mentioned, which is basically what we'd be doing, just kind of shifting away from our 401k system, where we have your pre-tax deferrals, and switching to kind of a post tax regime. So one of the reasons it's being mentioned is that it raises $400 billion in revenue. So as we've always said, the Republicans are certainly looking for that. Isn't really, you know, it keeps getting mentioned, but obviously there has been pushback from stakeholders in the retirement security community, it's certainly a concern of many of the stakeholders here. So wasn't addressed in the framework, hasn't necessarily got traction. But again, as with everything that risks the float around, we're certainly paying attention to that.
Well, David, I know you were watching the Senate Finance hearing the other day, so perhaps you want to, I know this issue came up and they were very focused on that. Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Sure. Senator Cardin from Maryland, did bring up the issue and also, made a strong statement about, the importance of increasing opportunities for retirement security, kind of sounding a warning that this wasn't the way to go. No one spoke in favor of it on either side. So really the only discussion of it was how this was probably not, necessarily something going to go around. So in terms of the committee, it's not something that's really, we're seeing getting traction, everybody championing, but still monitoring.
Yeah, we know there are others who are less vocal, but clearly looking at it. So we're very much watching that piece as well.
So I think that's a good transition. And Army, you kind of laid this out there in your metaphor of where's the spinach here. So seems like in the framework is a lot of what a lot of people like, right? Lower taxes, it's more simple. There's possible the doubling the standard deduction. So there's a lot of things that people like. What is not in here, though, is are there offsets? Where are those offsets? Any specific deductions that they're saying? It seems like charitable and mortgage are off the table at this point, but they didn't mention any other deductions that they would remove specifically. So anything that we know, is that a specific decision, a conscious decision to leave that information out of the package, out of the framework? If so, why? Kind of where are we at in terms of any potential revenue raisers here?
Well, clearly we don't know what they are, bottom line up front. I think if you're in an optimistic and complimentary mood this afternoon, or whenever, I don't know when Josh folks are going to get to listen to this, but then you would say they're being deferential to the committees and that work needs to be done. If you're being slightly more pessimistic about it, this is where stuff really gets hard. And I think if you go back to the turn of the year during transition from the election, you know, there was great unanimity for the last 7 years by Republicans of every stripe at every level, from presidential candidates to mayoral candidates, about the repeal and replace of Obamacare. And guess what? The devil, as it always is in the details. And once they got down to the brass tacks, and particularly when operating with such thin margins in the Senate, you know, you can lose a vote or two and you're nowhere, even if you have agreement on everything else. And I know that's frustrating, but it's, you know, our system of government was designed not to move with alacrity as a function of its constitutional bearing and reality. So I think the same thing is true when we talk about tax reform and tax cuts. It's an easy thematic to all rally behind, but the details are, or the devil is very much in the details and how this gets done. So we'll see.
And I would say on some level, just from a political perspective, it's tricky, right? Because as soon as you start putting stuff out there, you know, folks here in D.C. and people in the tax base and our membership have been looking at this for a little bit. Once you start going out there and putting up specific deductions and putting up specific changes, especially you're starting to see it on TV more and more every day. You're seeing it in the paper more and more every day. So as the broader country starts to focus on this a little bit more, when you start putting those up there, just politically makes things a little bit more difficult. So let's talk a little bit about time frame, right? So if this is the starting point, this is, you know, the starter's pistol going off. What are we looking on time frame? It seemed like earlier in the year, obviously Republicans had a pretty aggressive time frame to try to pass all this by August. That didn't work. So now they're looking a little bit more. Would love to get something possibly text in possibly October, maybe try to get something through and pass in the House by Thanksgiving and have this all done by the end of the year. Some other folks have maybe said a little bit more towards the first quarter of next year. So what do you guys think from where we are today and what you guys know in terms of time frame?
Well, I'll take the idealistic point of view, and I'll let David play the realist. If you talk to Speaker Ryan this afternoon, what he would tell you is that the House and Senate will proceed in parallel, that the budget will be done in 3 weeks, and after that, the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee will each begin their process with a bill, that they both houses, both chambers, will pass their bills by Thanksgiving individually. They will spend the month of December conferencing those products to create one unified piece of legislation. And then, you know, you'll have this as a nice tied under the bow for the holidays.
That is certainly the line that that we are going with with the Republican leadership. And again, they certainly are motivated to do it and get it done. I mean, I think, you know, they are going to struggle with several challenges. I mean, I think one, we've talked about the cost of reform. You know, the Senate did as Army was talking about the budget and the Senate, they allowed for $1.5 trillion in deficits over 10 years. That's in the resolution. But as we've talked about with the framework and the low rates, you know, that's going to require getting some revenues to do that. And once you start specifying those revenues, then the disagreements that Army discussed are going to come out. The groups that are impacted are going to make their voices known. So it becomes more difficult.
Because that's important, too, because under reconciliation, right, I mean, you're not, if you want this to be permanent law, you can't have you can't lose money on this necessarily. So if they want it to be permanent, they got to kind of focus on that end a little bit.
Exactly. So assuming that the $1.5 trillion makes it through, both houses pass it, or whatever number, that's the figure they can allow for the deficit, then yes, they can't go over that in the process. So the cost is going to be a challenge, first of all, and whether they're going to, you know, how they deal with that, still unknown, and what kind of pay for it you're going to get. And I think the political environment, too, is just, it's going to take a little more to sell. When you look at the last time, not the 86 reform, but, you know, 2001, 2003 Bush tax cuts, you know, the government budget was in surplus. This was billed as giving the money their people back, you know, the American people their money back. And, you know, just a different era. Now it's a different, you know, the budget. We had a $552 billion deficit last year. $20 trillion, as Army mentioned, in debt. The financial crisis, you know, has really kind of exacerbated the inequality that we've had. So, you know, as we saw Republicans trying to get out there in August, they're going to have to make that effort to kind of, you know, sell their reform to the American people. That's probably going to take some time to do. So I think we're thinking more, you know, March, April is kind of a more realistic time frame. But, you got to be prepared for it to go faster. So
yeah, I think that's important because, I mean, obviously Republicans are very much so want to do this and are incredibly motivated, especially after healthcare didn't go the way they wanted to. Trying to get a win on the board here is crucially important. So I think, you know, you could see this move really, really quickly, potentially. If they get some momentum on their back, you could see something happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the timeline I described requires a perfect game, and we all know how hard that is. But Josh is absolutely correct. I mean, you'll hear Republicans increasingly describe this in private and in public as a must-do item. Some have even begun to tie it to the future of congressional control in Republican hands. So that's very much true. The other date I would put on your radar, and I'm sure we'll come back to this in future issues of the pod, is, as Josh described, Luther Strange lost to Roy Moore this past Tuesday in the special election primary runoff. The general election is scheduled to take place on December 12th. And so that's another motivating date, because certainly while Judge Moore has suggested he will be in favor of the president's agenda, he's also qualified that by suggesting only if it meets with his own ideals. And certainly he is no friend, as Josh described, of Senator McConnell. And that makes the vote margin in the Senate that much more difficult and dicey. So mark your calendars for December 12th. That could be another thunderclap. And the other political implication that is absolutely true with this is Steve Bannon is on the warpath, and he is taking the war to Republican incumbent senators primarily, but also probably some House members with every fiber of his being. So.
And as we get closer into next year, once the midterms start looking closer in that mirror, people then get a little bit more trepidatious about big votes. So we'll definitely see that. So thank you guys very much for coming today. Appreciate it. A lot of things are going to change and happen over the next couple of months. So as Army and David alluded to, they did produce a great news wire. It's got a lot of information on what was in the framework. You'll see a lot of podcasts, a lot of webinars, a lot of calls that you can be on. Reach out to us. Let us know, you know, what you're hearing. Let us know if you want to plug in. Give us a call. Phone number is 202-742-4638. Happy to help walk you through anything, answer any questions you might have as we continue to kind of monitor the situation here in D.C. So thanks, everybody, again, for coming. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will talk to you soon.
Take care.